Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. New Mexico is a poor state. How many times have you heard that? How many times have you said that when describing a problem or telling other people about our state? The federal definition of poverty is someone who makes less than about $11,700 a year. A family of four living under the poverty line makes about $24,000 a year. According to the U.S. Census, one in five New Mexicans are living below the poverty line. But what's missing from those numbers? And can we change the conversation about poverty in a way that helps us identify new solutions and sources of strength in our communities? That's our focus this hour. We have some great guests with us to tackle this question, including Dr. Nancy Lopez, Associate Professor in the Sociology Department at UNM and Director and Co-Founder of the Institute for the Study of Race and Social Justice. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Moises Gonzalez, Associate Professor in the Community and Regional Planning Program at UNM. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
You can join us by calling 277-5866. You can also send an email to letstalk@kunm.org or use the hashtag letstalknm on Twitter. Moises, I want to start with you. I just gave these statistics out. When you hear those stats, when you hear those numbers, what comes to mind for you?
What comes to mind to me working out of the Community Regional Planning Program in partnerships with local governments, nonprofits, all over New Mexico, rural New Mexico. We see a lot of things. We saw a lot of out-migration from rural areas into urban areas, and we see kind of seasonal jobs in these areas in the rural north, and then we see a lot of outside investment in places like Taos. Taos is historically majority minority county, and when it shifted in 2010, people were like, "Wow, that's a northern county." So, when we look at the gentrification, the outside investment that's going into to these sort of counties, or the investment and gentrification, we see that in the rural areas. In the cities, we see the kind of things where it's like you drive to, you qualify, and you see areas like the Southwest Mesa that had such high in terms of foreclosures. We see the homeless problems in Albuquerque throughout New Mexico that we just can't see finding the sort of solutions. Done a lot of work in the international district around in terms of creating walkable infrastructure for folks that are dependent on public transportation. And, you know, we have an art system that's ending right at the start of the international district. So we have policies and policy and investment that are happening in ways that that are showing that are visible now. They're not in the shadows anymore.
That people are being left out.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, we have two members of OLE, that's Organizers in the Land of Enchantment. That's a local nonprofit that advocates for working families in New Mexico. Sheila Alves, thanks for being here this morning.
Yeah, for sure.
What about, Moises was just talking about policy, about where, you know, there are resources, who's being left out. What comes to mind for you when you hear these statistics about poverty?
Well, as I was kind of mentioning earlier, I do work at a women's housing program. And so thinking about people who are being left out, a lot of the guidelines in terms of who we can house at my job leave a lot of people out. You have to have certain things or kind of be at a certain place in your life in terms of your risk in order to be housed. And so a lot of times there are people who are like, well, I'm just homeless, or, you know, I just can't find a job. I'm just living in my car. I don't have, you know, a criminal history. I don't have a mental illness. And those are people who are just kind of left on the wayside because we can't house them just based on funding. And so I think that, like, even though there are things in place to try to help people, I think a lot of people are just kind of being left aside because they're not high enough on the risk factor, or they're still okay despite not having food to eat and not having a place to live.
Yeah, these numbers are imperfect, but they really matter. There's something real at stake for folks.
Yeah.
Nancy, what about you? What comes to mind when you hear these statistics about poverty?
So I think of my own experience growing up in New York City. I've been in New Mexico for 17 years, and I grew up in poverty. I grew up in public housing. And I think about the policies that made a difference for me and the potential that we have to do that in New Mexico. So, for instance, we had pre-K programs, right? Head Start. I was a Head Start baby. My parents migrated here from the Dominican Republic, and though they had very important messages about the importance of school, and they had no practical knowledge with that. There was Upward Bound in my high school, where there was no opportunity to connect with colleges. So I think about how is it that we can intervene and create structures of opportunity for communities that have historically not had access to mobility ladders like higher education, employment services, et cetera. And I think that we have a strategic opportunity to do that here in New Mexico.
Absolutely. What do you think counts as poverty? Are we counting the right things? And are the numbers that we're talking about here of 20% of New Mexicans living below the poverty line, do you think that's really accurate? The number to join our conversation today is 277-5866. Again, that's 277-5866. And on Twitter, you can use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. I'd also like to bring in Gina Dennis, another member of Olay. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you're a lawyer.
Yes.
And so these are, you know, these legal definitions. What are you kind of seeing and dealing with in your work when it comes to poverty guidelines and what that means for the people that you're working with?
So what I do is I deal with federal law and I deal with tribal law. And so my job is to represent a lot of the pueblos as sovereign nations. And holistically, when we look at this issue of defining poverty, one of the biggest issues that I see is that this federal definition of poverty, like Shayla was saying, does exclude a lot of people. And not just on like who competes with living literally below the poverty line or right at it, but also understanding what it means to be part of the working poor or the so-called working class, which actually these are folks who are actually living in poverty, but for whatever reason, the federal government has not evaluated them in that way because they put this other benchmark of, what was it, 23,000?
About 24,000 for a family of four.
Right. So, you know, what if someone makes 27,000? Are they not living in poverty?
Yeah.
Right. So I think there's this tremendous stigma surrounding this word poor, poverty. And it's almost a shaming psychology that we have in America, where if somebody is poor, if someone is living in poverty, that somehow we're blaming that person for that situation, when in fact there are institutional structures in place that reinforce institutional poverty every day. And we're putting the blame on the individual rather than focusing on what is it that went wrong in the government that led to this outcome. How is it that we have people who have $5 billion in the bank, but somehow there are other people who can't even get a cup of water and who are living on the street? What is going on in America where we are relegating people to a status that is almost not human?
Mm. Moises, when, you know, talking about these institutional barriers that Gina just mentioned, what are some that you see? Institutional barriers that are keeping people in poverty, specifically in New Mexico?
The basic one is regulation of housing. I had some students that worked on, actually, it was an award-winning project. It was called the Secondary Dwelling Unit, SDU plus U. It was a concept where you have a single-family house and you allow another dwelling to be built on that structure, or so it allows for intergenerational housing. Cohabitation housing. So in terms of this idea, let's go back to how zoning's created. If you look at like the normalization of suburbs in the United States, it's not like unlike the eastern part of the United States where most of the city was built before World War II. If you go out west, most of the city was built after World War II. So if you look at the city of Albuquerque, we have 70% of our housing in terms of available housing is single family housing. That means we still have to, even though we have these changing dynamics in our economics, these changing dynamics It's like people can't run a small business out of your garage. You need a storefront. You need this sort of in terms, and it's a way to control the capital so people can't generate wealth. Or generate ways or new ways or innovative ways to allow income to be made out of the home. We also have this notion that it comes out of this idea of the normal family. It's a heterosexual, patriarchal family that it can only be, you know, this idea of a woman, man, and two kids, right? What about grandma? What about, you know, different ways where, you know, maybe we can be more resourceful of 2-3 families living in a 3,000 bedrooms square foot home. It starts there, and then it's perpetuated into how commercial zoning's created. It's perpetuated how, in terms of mixed use housing develops, are now becoming the gentrifying force. So it's a way in which capital is isolated in these notions of normality of where investment can happen and where investment can happen, and with those targets are targeted in ways in which. There are ways in which minorities and folks living in poverty are going to have less access to be able to live in what's considered a normal home. So these are just such barriers, right? And so my students presented to the city council. All the neighborhood associations shot us down. And guess what? You know, we were nominated for a national award, and everyone was saying this is a great idea. However, the politics on the ground, just it's not acceptable.
Nancy, I see you nodding your head as well.
I think what Moises pointed out is absolutely on target. So if we focus on the institutional policies that we know 10 years from now, we can see a dent that will make a dent. I mentioned pre-K and Head Start as one very important one, housing, the unfairness of institutional barriers that prohibit families from subsisting in the circumstances they find themselves, Medicaid rules that may be impacting the most vulnerable communities that will not have access because they don't meet by $3,000 the federal guideline. I know I wouldn't be in the situation I have if those policies hadn't existed. But there's also very important other large policy items that, if passed at the state level or even at the national level, could make a dent on the racialized poverty that we see. Because one of the things we have to remember is if race is not biology, it's a social status, right? That's usually assigned based on what you look like, what I call street race. You know, if you were walking down the street, what race do you think others who do not know you would automatically assume you were? Then we have to understand that there's something about the institutions that we live in, the mechanisms and the processes that are treating entire categories of people differently. So what if we created what my colleagues at the Duke Center on Social Equity, William Darity, Derek Hamilton have called baby bonds. The idea that based on the wealth, because we know income is just one indicator of wealth, that you're born into, by the time you reach the age of 18, you receive funding for either college, for starting a business, or for purchasing a home, and to create intergenerational wealth. Because currently we don't have any policies that address the racialized wealth gap that we have. It is also true that people at the same level of education are not paid the same based on race. We also need intersectional analysis because this may differ for men and women. We have to look at issues of nativity. Are there differences for those that are U.S. born versus foreign born? There are policies that could produce full employment to address these issues. And again, a lot of these policy solutions are doable and feasible if we have a state context or even a municipal context. Seattle has a racial justice initiative that's been embraced by the city to address issues like infrastructure, de facto segregation in our schools, housing discrimination, full employment, and equitable pay by race and gender. I know currently our city has a gender equity policy, but to what degree does that address racial equity and pay? So we have the potential. We have the tools. We just need the political will. Money is policy.
Money is policy. And we want to hear from you today. Does your income fall below the poverty line, or is it near the poverty line? You're one of those people who say, you know, this is really not helping me, this definition of poverty. It's not capturing my real experience. I'm struggling, but I can't, you know, access any resources. Or are you, as one of our guests, Gina, mentioned, experiencing that blame and that stigma for your financial situation right now? How would you like to see us talk about poverty differently in New Mexico in a way that doesn't define people by their income? The number to call today, 277 877-587-5866. We're also live tweeting the show. Send us your comments with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're going to go to a quick break and we'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Program support comes from Listen Up, New Mexico's resource for hi-fi, home theater, and smart home systems since 1972. Located at 6916 Montgomery Boulevard Northeast or online at listenup.com.
Coming up, cellist Raphael Bell plays music he never used to like.
Sometimes when we're young, we develop funny prejudices against certain composers, and I don't know why, but I wasn't interested in finding out more about Martinu.
We'll find out more about Bohuslav Martinu and why Raphael Bell now loves his music on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Our focus today is the definition of poverty. Do you think we should talk about poverty differently? How? We want to hear from you today. Our number is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. Let's go now to the phone lines. We have Wally in Santa Fe. Wally, what's your story?
Hey, thank you for having me on. Well, I have a very interesting combination of family. I'm supporting pretty much four or five children. I have five children. Two of them are very young. I want to get one of them that's 16, 18 months. She's 18 months old. I wanted to get her in the early childhood program in Santa Fe Community College. The catch was that, you know, it's $1,100 a month. I couldn't afford that. They told me to apply for assistance at CYFD. CYFD says, you make too much money, so I'm stuck in the middle. And who's suffering? My little daughter, who, you know, is not, it can't get into the program. You know, it's evidence that early childhood is very good for children in the long term. I was wondering if there's, and I'm sure there is, but there's possibilities to galvanize, like, communities like Los Alamos Lab community, a lot of seniors, sort of wealthy people who, you know, for instance, they have foundations on the Santa Fe Community College, and, you know, they support the community college here in Santa Fe. And I was just wondering, you know, politically speaking, how do we mobilize to get, the viable politicians in office to, get these kind of programs that are needed desperately in our community?
Wally, I'm going to put your question to two of our members from Olay that are with us today. That's organizers in the Land of Enchantment. Gina, do you want to pick up on that?
Sure. Wally, thanks for calling in. So here's the issue. A lot of times when we talk about policy and the need for politicians that are actually representing what the people want, we tend to not look at ourselves as the solution. And, you know, more and more people, everyday people just like you, just like me, need to be running for office so that we remove this notion of a politician and replace that with a public servant.
Yeah. Shayla, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, for me, what my idea would be, as much as we should be able to rely on politicians and the people that we elect to represent us, I think, like Gina said, we can also take things into our own hands. If you know people in your community who are also experiencing the same thing, like, you all should be able to band together and in a way, like, make it happen for yourselves. That's really the only way that things are going to truly get done. I think volunteerism is extremely important. And I think if it's possible, like, why can't we as a community help out each other and create these programs for ourselves, volunteer at these programs for ourselves, and really, like, raise and teach our own communities? You know, I'm a strong believer in the phrase, it takes a village. So, yeah.
Yeah, for folks listening today, do you know of a grassroots effort to kind of do that, to get together and to solve some of these problems like access to childcare, having a safe place to put your kids and know that they're going to be taken care of and they're going to maybe even learn during the day? Give us a call and tell us if you know of a program happening in New Mexico right now, 277-5866. Let's go now to Glenaba and Albuquerque. You have a question for Nancy?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Nancy, this is Glenaba. And I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about how historical socio-political conditions specific to New Mexico operate in the understanding of poverty. And I'm talking about how access to water rights, land tenure, and even the idea of sovereign nations, 24 sovereign nations now within the state of New Mexico, how does that fit into one's understanding of poverty, especially because we are who we are in New Mexico, which is qualitatively different from some states in the United States.
So Dr. Glenaba Martinez is one of my most esteemed and honored colleagues. I hope everyone reads Native Pride, The Politics of Urban Education for Native Youth. Thank you, Glenaba, for that question. I'm so glad you brought it up. I think what's incredibly important is for us to deeply contextualize the history of New Mexico. So it's very easy to look at numbers and say, well, there's something wrong with these people because, historically, they have not had the same level of success in school or employment, et cetera. But without a deep analysis of the history and embracing that history and feeling uncomfortable with that history as a way forward, in other words, recognizing the history of colonization, settler colonialism, patriarchy, heterosexism, systemic racism, all the isms that we know are structural, exist outside of the individual, and have a history, a unique history here in New Mexico. I'm so thrilled that we were selected to host the Critical Race Studies and Education Association Conference, which will take place next week at UNM's main campus in the Student Union Building, the Sub. And the theme is Land and Knowledge, Indigeneity, Survivance, and Healing. We have several keynotes that are going to focus on tribal critical race theory, which is really centering that history and embracing it with all of its challenges as a place of hope and opportunity for change. If we know that there have been structures of inequality in place, how do we transform that, of colonization in our curriculum? So one of the panels that we will also have is on ethnic studies policy with colleagues in Arizona, Texas, here in New Mexico, who've been doing incredible work to transform our curriculum, to make it one of hope, healing, and wellness, and empowerment for communities that have systematically experienced inequities in school. And then the last panel will be on race in New Mexico and the way forward. If this is an uncomfortable topic for a lot of people, it's okay. We can get through the discomfort and create something new so that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when we are long gone, we can see that we have made a difference in the inequities that we've seen here historically because of all of those factors that Dr. Martinez was alluding to. So thank you for that question. If anyone's interested, you can visit the website for critical race theory. It's crsea.org, and you can find information on registration there.
We'll also put a link up on our website. Nancy, I think, though, some people, there's this growing awareness of we need to talk about race when we talk about poverty. We need to bring these things to the surface. We need to, even though it's uncomfortable, bring it out. I think some folks listening might be like, well, in New Mexico, we're different. We're a state of, mostly Latino folks, mostly brown folks. Like, so how, why do we need to talk about that? We have Latinos in the legislature.
Because we recently completed a study at a public university in New Mexico that looked at graduation rates. And over 30 years, we've seen very little change, right? So Native American graduation rates are always the lowest. Next is African American and then Hispanic. There's a color line that's also shaped by gender dynamics. But what we did, which was different, was look at income, race, and gender together. And we found that even when we are looking at high income Native American or African American and even Hispanics, you still see a color line. So what does that tell us? It tells us that if we want to develop policies like the funding formula for our state legislature for institutions of higher ed, assume that class is a proxy for race. That's not enough. We would never make that assumption for gender. In other words, your class does not predict your inequities in terms of race or gender. So we need to embrace this complexity. Why do we need to focus on race in New Mexico? Because when we show up to look for an apartment, we know there's been studies that included New Mexico that say if you're a visible minority, if you're brown, black, or seen as other, if you're someone who's seen as a racially stigmatized minority, you may not have access. And that's unjust. And so if we value justice and equity and we love this beautiful country that we live in and we want to make this better for everyone, we have to embrace that ugly reality and change it. And so even if we are a majority minority state, the sedimentation of poverty and inequities in all these arenas, healthcare, education, employment, are still there. And we need and we have policy solutions that we can actually execute.
Do you see historical connections to what we're talking about today? Are you relating to what Nancy just shared about you've experienced that racism here in New Mexico? Are we doing enough to talk about that, to acknowledge that experience that people are having, to acknowledge historical trauma, colonization, and other parts of our history, and how they contribute to the struggles in our communities today? We want to hear from you. The number is 277-5866. Again, that's 277-5866. Moises, you have a comment you want to add about the legacy of colonization and what that means about how we got to where we are today.
Well, it's an important conversation. It's a conversation that's always swept under the rug in the sense that, you know, in terms of our, in terms of being colonized by the Spanish, being colonized by the United States and still under this, and even going back to when this was brief period when this is Mexico, there's, you know, the elites, there's always this, there's this history of the elites aligning with the economic systems and the political systems that exploit poor people and exploit communities. So it's still happening today. You know, we have an educational system, an economic system that exploits northern New Mexico and appropriates aspects of our culture and actually turns it into aspects of economic development. It's happened since the De Vargas Fiesta. It happens with the Española Fiesta in terms of how we build these sorts of events around economic development that create historical trauma. Then there's an exploitation system of how economics play out, how it's played out on land-grant communities and how it's played on Acequia communities. And it puts us in a position where, you know, these collective resources, that's the problem. New Mexico used to, we have these conversations about socialism, and we talk about, you know, in terms of how schools should be appropriately funded. Well, if we look at the history in New Mexico, these are highly systems in New Mexico, northern New Mexico, were highly collective. The land grant system was a communal system. The acequia system is a communal system. The cofradías that operated within were mutual aid societies. When you start extracting that, and in the schools, we perpetuate, and American capitalism perpetuates the individual exceptionalism. When you start embedding that, a system of economics in places like Truchas and places like Abiquiu, you allow economic development driven by places by individuals like the Georgia O'Keeffe Foundation that are adding to the gentrification and the destruction of communities like El Pueblo de Abiquiu.
Mm. We have a comment from Twitter from Ivy. She says, poverty is unemployment, environmental and institutional racism, lack of housing, and a lack of community essentials like grocery stores, libraries, and swimming pools. I want to go back now to Shayla and Gina. What Moises was just talking about with colonization, the legacy of all of that, you know, communities, you know, being forced to move away from that collective and communal model. How do you, when you're working with people on, like, issues right now, childcare, how do you connect those dots with people in LA about the history and then the very real problems people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis right now? Gina?
Well, you know, we definitely have a race problem in America and definitely in New Mexico. New Mexico is a majority people of color state. And, you know, if we do things the right way, we can be a model for the United States because we're heading towards a majority-minority population across the United States. And if we do it the right way in New Mexico, the rest of the United States can be prepared and learn. And there is no doubt that there is a direct correlation between institutional racism and poverty. And poverty has also been institutionalized. And we have a problem in New Mexico where there is this tendency to sweep race issues under the rug. And a lot of the institutions in New Mexico are operated by white people. And it's uncomfortable in that, you know, when you're like, in this organization, and everyone who's running it is white, and then when you look outside of the window and you see all these people of color, you know, how is it that a small group of white people can understand or dictate or decides what is best for people of color who may have a completely different cultural awareness and socialization? And that brings us back to these issues of childhood poverty and the need for programs that have funding for early childhood education in different neighborhoods, but also have this respect for the differences in culture and respecting and understanding that programs need to be funded to support people of color while also respecting the cultural differences and being sensitive about how that culture operates.
Shayla, you want to pick up and add something here?
A little bit. So really quick, I did want to just say a little bit earlier, in terms of race in New Mexico, I don't know a whole lot of people here that identify themselves as Latino. I mostly see people identifying as Hispanic. And I think there's a huge difference in being a visibly brown or a visibly black person and being a person who has blonde hair and blue eyes with the last name Martinez. Huge, huge difference, right? Huge disparity there. And I think having a Spanish last name doesn't necessarily make you a person of color. And so I'll just leave that there for people to percolate on. But I also think in terms of our organizations and how we try to reach our community and how we try to reach the public, I think we should be more open. This is like a very academic conversation that we're having. How can we change the language to be more inclusive so that the people that we're trying to help actually knows what's going on so that they can, how do we empower them to have these discussions with themselves? Mm-hmm. And to really try to figure these things out on their own instead of us, you know, academic folks telling them what they should be doing.
Where should we start with that? What are some of the language, the things that we could change, the kind of the words that we could use? Where do you think we could start?
I definitely think, you know, there are words that are $10 words. How do we change that up? How do we just say blatantly to folks, like, this is what's happening. This is what the problem is. What do you all think we can do to help support you? What do you all think we can do to change this? And yeah, just having more maybe workshops, more forums, more open spaces that are free, right? More events, more discussions that are free that you don't have to pay, or more events and more discussions that have childcare. You know, you don't have to miss out on this because you don't have a babysitter or something like that.
Yeah. And what do you think would change if the folks who are experiencing, you know, because yeah, a lot of times the conversation is like, oh, we're talking about those poor people in New Mexico and what's going on with them. What can change if we're like, what are the solutions in your community? What are you seeing? Like, really bring those people into those opportunities for power and discussion. Gina, did you want to start with that?
Yeah. So one of the things I do in my free time is I help with organizing the Poor People's Campaign in New Mexico, which is also a national movement. And the Poor People's Campaign is putting these issues of poverty on the front line. And what we need to do is make sure that when we talk about people and we're having conversations about people of color, it needs to be people of color in those conversations. When we are having conversations about people living in poverty, it needs to be people who are living in poverty who are having those conversations. And the other thing is there's something called the Recipe for Fairness and Justice, and it includes four elements. One is that this notion of proximity. Another is changing the narrative. The other is being uncomfortable, and the other one is hope. And with proximity, people need to make these issues of race and these issues of poverty proximate to them. So if it's true that we do have this 1% and this 99%, well, that would also mean that it's true that it's possible that most people living in America are friends with or are related to or affiliated with someone who is living in poverty. And so we need to make that proximate. Acknowledge that these issues are actually close to us. They're close to everyone. And then with changing the narrative, that's what we're talking about here. You know, what kind of language should we use? What does the word Hispanic mean as opposed to Latina, Chicano? And who's writing the narrative? If, middle-class heterosexual white people are writing the narrative for poor people of color, then we have a serious problem. It needs to be those poor people of color that are telling their story so that people can understand. And then the other element is being uncomfortable. And the professor here mentioned, she literally said, she talked about this notion of being uncomfortable, and that's really powerful. People need to feel uncomfortable, and they need to understand that that is a good thing, because you cannot have change in places of comfort. And then the last is hope, and that is this notion that for some people, hope is all they have, and that's real. The hope that things will get better, the hope that things will change, and the fact that there are people in this country who all they have is hope. Like, they don't have a bank account, they don't have a car, they don't have health insurance, they don't have access to education. They don't have any equity in their life. And all they have is hope. And there are a lot of people living like that today. We need to use these models like the Recipe for Fairness and Justice when we talk about these issues.
Mm. Shayla, you want to add something real quick? We need to go to a break, but you can have one comment before we do.
Just really quick, I did want to give an example of what Ole does and how Ole has been a model of what I was talking about during the paid sick leave campaign. Also, like, concurrently, while we were having those meetings, there were citizenship classes going on. And those people who are there studying English or studying to take the citizenship test can come into those paid sick leave meetings, right? They're able to engage in that way. They're able to engage in activism in that way and learn how to fight for things that can apply to them. And so I just think that there should be more of that.
More opportunities for people to drive that change themselves and be part of the conversation. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. What does it mean to be poor in New Mexico? We're talking a little bit here about how we can move forward, how we can get more people involved. Do you have ideas of how you would like for us to talk about poverty, or how you would like to see people brought into the conversation from communities that are experiencing poverty to talk about the solutions they want to see, talk about the narrative they want to have about their experience, their lived experience in New Mexico? Our number is 877-899-5866. You can also email us today. It's letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back.
The first ever Indigenous Fashion Week Toronto promises tons of fashion, textiles, and crafts from some of the top Indigenous designers. They're also presenting hands-on workshops and panel discussions. On the next Native America Calling, we'll meet with the organizers and some First Nations designers for a celebration of Indigenous fashion.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
It isn't every day we get a new or newer vehicle. Some of us hang on until they've got 200, maybe 300,000 miles on them. Nothing wrong with that. But when it's time to get the next one, how great to send it off to continue to serve. Not just you and your family, but the entire community by funding KUNM. Give us a call and we'll send a tow truck, handle the sale, and then send you a tax receipt and a KUNM membership. Keep doing good. Call 888-KUNM-CAR.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. There's still time to join our conversation this morning. What do you want to add about poverty in New Mexico and how you would like to see us talk about it now and in the future? The number again, 277-5866. Let's go to John in El Prado. John, what do you want to add today?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, go ahead, John.
I just wanted to throw my own $10 word into this conversation. The word is commensalism, and that's just a fancy way of talking about how people share things. In the Pueblo of Zuni, for example, in the middle of winter, guy will go out to sheep camp, slaughter sheep, bring it back into the Pueblo, and by the end of the day, he maybe has a quarter of that sheep in his larder. The rest of it's scattered all over town. It's the same way with corn, and it's the same way with firewood. And all I'm saying is that this sort of sharing isn't figured into how much the average family income is. Anyway, that's all. That's all.
That's an important point. There are these cultural traditions and values, especially in New Mexico, that can be a real source of strength for communities. And I'd love for us to talk more about that, too. If you want to share about that, the number 277-5866. Let's go now to Georgina in Las Vegas. Georgina, thanks for calling in this morning. What do you want to add?
Well, good morning. Great topic. Great conversation. My comment here is in Las Vegas, we have what they call a food desert on the west side. All there is an awesome and a dollar store. Now, how does a mother or a family scraping the barrel, $25,000 or under, how do they feed their family? We had to go to city council last week and ask permission to get a zoning, to get a farmer's market on the west side. There are two farmer's markets, the one on the east, the one on the west now. But the east side did not want to come and set up house at the new site that the city had offered because we were too poor, too many alcoholics, and too many drug dealers. Hello? You have the same amount on the east side. But this is how they continuously put us up their stereotype people. The other thing my comment was, I think Moises had said about George O'Keefe and its foundation. Well, you know, they're not the only ones that are doing that stuff. It's also the Main Streets. It's also the Arts Councils. It's also all of these organizations who use our culture as a tool for prostitution. How they get their money, they use, oh, well, this is for the people. This is for this. It's not benefiting any of the people it's meant to. It's just using the money, using the people, like, you know, the old saying, oh, I like the hat, me gusta la sombrero, pero la Mexicano or the Indian, no. It's alive. It's still here. And that conversation has to be on the table, whether it's politically correct or incorrect. We need to put that on the front burner and constantly make people uncomfortable. Because let me tell you, if you got to walk 5 miles to go get food for your family, it's not comfortable either. So we need to start bringing that to the table and talking about it. And if they don't like it and they don't feel comfortable, try 500 years of slavery and the beating down of people of color. That was uncomfortable, and that still is uncomfortable. And they got to live with it because, let me tell you, we've already been through it. And it needs to be at the front of every conversation. That's what I have to say.
Georgina, thanks for calling in today. You hit on a lot of things that we're talking about this hour. Nancy, you want to react to some of the things that Georgina shared?
Thank you, Georgina, for having the courage to make to do some truth-telling, to really speak your truth, and to honor the reality of the history of survival and resistance to systemic exclusion, oppressions, et cetera. And I think that that is the key. I want everyone who's listening right now to think about what your intersecting social location and experiences and structures of inequality. What do I mean? When we think about the comments that Shayla was making, that race, or what I call street race, is not the same as ancestry. We could all take a DNA test right now and find out we have 10 different ancestry. That's not going to change how we are seen by others when we show up at the door to look at an apartment or when we look for employment. That's not the same as tribal status. So we absolutely need to first also recognize that we need good data, data that does not conflate those things. Those are things that are different. Ethnicity is not the same thing as a street race or race or color. We also need good data on gender. There's an entire community of homeless LGBT youth that have nowhere to go. And depending on the rules of shelters, they may even be excluded and treated unfairly. We need data that is separately collecting sexual orientation and gender and sex assigned at birth. We also need to collect data on parental educational attainment in K-12. We were successful in doing that at the University of New Mexico through a consortium we started. It's called the New Mexico Statewide Race, Gender, and Class Data Policy Consortium. And it's really trying to build a community of practice of not only researchers at the university, but also practitioners and community groups that centers and harmonizes the data that we collect to serve vulnerable communities. So when we have data on all of these things, and we absolutely look at how the simultaneity of race, gender, and class are operating, we can absolutely serve our communities better.
And Nancy, Shayla mentioned earlier the need to kind of make conversations accessible. How do we make data as accessible as possible so communities can utilize that research that you're doing in a real way on the work that they're trying to do on things that they're seeing?
So right now there's a lot going on with the census. Whatever the census does, we have the right and the ability to collect data that responds to the needs of our community. So we know we have a large Native American community here. We need to collect detailed data on tribal status here. What we can do is, of course, we have to aggregate data that we collect on Hispanics to whatever the census wants us to do, but we can collect Hispanic origin as separate from race. In other words, are white Latinos living in the same neighborhoods as black and brown Latinos? We need to know if they're living in food deserts, right? We need to know if they're having access to health care. The idea that in Las Vegas, apparently there wasn't for a long time, I don't know if that's changed, an obstetrician who could do C-sections. So we absolutely can make that happen at the local level. Schools can collect parental educational attainment. We can, that would help us serve our communities better. So contextualized data, we can do that.
Wait, I'm sorry. Gina, did you want to jump in there too?
Sure. So thank you, Georgina, for bringing this conversation to a higher level. So I'm very much on the ground and in the communities. I do a lot of community organizing at the neighborhood level. And I organize about 17 different neighborhoods. And what Georgina is talking about is a modern day colonization, where there are communities with their own culture in how they harvest and sell food, and that's within the context of these farmers markets. And then through city governmental ordinances, it becomes difficult to maintain those cultural structures, and they are replaced with a multinational corporation that looks like a small storefront. And so this is where the organizing within the neighborhoods becomes really important, and to preserve your culture and to preserve your collective way of life. And it's also, again, I reiterate, being in every structure, and that people need to be electing from their community the people that they want to serve them. So it should be someone from your community that you are electing and that you're putting in city council. That way you don't end up in these situations where you have a structure that's actually operating against you, like a city council, and as a result, you're left powerless without any actual representation. So it's that building the community, organizing your neighborhoods, and then also making sure that you've got people who are on your team from your community that are running for office and being elected.
I'd like to go now to a couple more calls, and we'll come back here. Steve from Espanola, what's the comment you want to make today?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the term colonization. You have to be careful with it. You know, and unfortunately, KUNM, you guys have really abused that term, because Native American communities had been colonizing each other long before the Spanish arrived, long before the Anglos arrived. The Yakima Pueblo controlled the slave trade in the central Rio Grande corridor. Nomadic tribes were engaged in colonization and slavery. And so the important narrative here is that we use the term cautiously. And colonialism, you know, your show, KUNM, you guys really use it in a pointed way against the Hispanics and the Anglo community, and you need to be careful with that. Now, I taught at the Chicano Studies Department for 6 years, and I've been teaching Chicano Studies for 18 years. I'm a fifth-generation college graduate. I'm a second-generation professor here in New Mexico. And poverty, I agree with your discussion on poverty. The key is education. And the other aspect I want to point out is that you need to really stop victimizing New Mexico. New Mexico has a rich history, a proud history, a successful history. And KUNM does a very good job of constantly victimizing us instead of celebrating the accomplishments of New Mexico and the celebrating the accomplishment of Chicanos and Chicano Studies, what it's done for the state of New Mexico. You need to celebrate that as opposed to constantly victimizing us. And the last point I want to make is why the word Hispanic is relevant to us. It comes from the word Hispanicus, and that was the self-imposed term that the Roman legions from Spain, how they identified themselves. So that word has Hispanic relevance to us, where the term Latino, that was invented by some Hollywood guy, and it's a shame that our people are using that word when it was imposed upon them. It was contrived, where the term Hispanic has historical roots. And I do a good job of erasing that term Latino from the college classrooms that I teach in northern New Mexico. So please, KUNM, I stopped funding you.
All right. Steve, we're coming up to the end of the hour, and so we need to – this is kind of a big question, a big thing that we don't have certainly enough time to get to all of it. But Moises, do you want to kind of jump in there on
Mr. Salazar, I'm actually, my mom's from northern New Mexico. So I think you really need to look deep into the colonial record and talk. If we want to talk about slavery, we can look at the slave trades that were perpetuated in the 19th century. There are a number of books that talk about that. So I think in terms of shying away, even how the word Spanish American identity was created, even at the onset of statehood, to sell Mexicans through whiteness, that way we could actually become a state because there was too many Mexicans living here. So I think what we do is I'm sorry, but I disagree with your comment because you're perpetuating aspects of true colonization that we can't address. And in doing so, what you're doing is you're acknowledging the power systems of the elites, such as Thomas Catron and Cleophas Chavez, that were the ones that created the economic and political systems that took away community land grants and privatized land. So I have to disagree with you that in your citations of looking at the historical record, because I totally disagree.
We're coming up on the end of the hour for Let's Talk New Mexico, but we do want to continue this conversation, continue to talk about strengths in our communities, to talk about history, talk about identity and what this means for us today, especially when we talk about poverty. The conversation doesn't have to end here. Use the hashtag Let's Talk NM on Twitter or go to KUNM.org where you can leave your comments about today's show and let us know what you'd like to see us talk about in the future, who you'd like to see on the show next. Again, that's KUNM.org. And if you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And next time on Let's Talk New Mexico, we'll examine our closed primary system ahead of the June 5th primary election. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Mallory Begay screened your calls today. And Celia Rainey live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is the executive producer. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.